I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick try to act as coordinators, as net control, to almost control this crazy crowd, that very enthusiastic group that meets in the New York City area once every week at Sunday at night for the so-called technical net. We discuss ham radio, our favorite subject, and quite a few things related to it. I'm claiming this is the brand new technical net. By significant request, almost demand last week, people wanted us to change the methods by which the TechNet is being operated. And I finally started listening to these guys. I, for an awful long period of time, thought that we're just having trouble pleasing everyone at once, but there's really something more going on. A significant number of new people were signing in during the first hour and having to wait what they feel is an extremely long period of time before we finally got to their particular question. So the new improved technical net, let's see how this is going to work out. We claim that during the first hour, only relatively simple, fast-to-answer type questions are going to be taken. In other words, as long as you guys really contribute to this thing, by that I mean a whole bunch of people sign up with what they believe to be quick questions. And it's all right to have a question that you believe has a quick section and a slow section. Let me drop. In other words, right now our mode of operation is going to be that during the first hour, we try to handle as many customers as possible. A new person signing in, maybe he's got to leave by 9 o'clock, maybe he only has a limited amount of time that he can listen, and maybe he has a limited amount of patience. We can understand that. And as such, light answers will be given. Where there is a deeper portion to the question, I'll simply mention to people that, yes, you've heard half the story, and during the next hour, when we've got time for the longer, deeper subjects, we'll dig into the other areas. So that, did somebody want to say something? So in other words, in some cases, you'll only be getting the headlines on more complicated subjects. You'll be told the what, not necessarily the how or why. And that we'll be discussing during the second hour. Some of the things we'll be discussing tonight are the HAARP, that very high-power radar that's in that ionospheric heating device that's in Alaska. We'll also be discussing some of the intricacies of the Hewlett-Packard 3561. But as I said, these are the subjects we'll be discussing during the second hour. Maybe we'll mention lightly a couple of the characteristics during the first hour. So hopefully there's a lot of people signing in with what they believe to be quick questions. And mention when you do sign in whether or not you think your question is going to have a simple part and a complicated part. We'll handle the simple part during the first hour. So it is right now. Let me drop. The first hour of operation will be fast questions, hopefully getting to everyone who signs in, at least with a partial answer. Mel's mailbag, we'll try to handle that by the end of the hour so that we start that as close to 9 o'clock as possible. And if there's extra time left over between now and 9 o'clock, we'll squeeze in Paul's space report. And there's some interesting things going on there in space. In fact, it reminds me, I've got to go get my latest issue of Sky and Telescope magazine. The December issue had some exciting things that are being discovered as far as habitable planets, Earth-like planets that they're discovering going around other solar systems. There's more and more evidence that we're not alone. Okay, a person signs into the technical net during the first hour by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a quick question or comment, what you believe to be a quick question or comment. Give me your call letters right now and name, K2RIW listening.
K2YO, yes.
KC2AZ, Bob, yes.
Okay, we had a quadruple. I heard K2YO, KC2AZ, I guess it was, yes, Bob. Those are the two that I've heard so far. Who are the others?
2RSO, Frank, yes.
Okay, so we've got Bernie, I think it is, YO. Bernie, Bob, and Frank. Who else did I miss so far?
Yeah, good evening, this is K2KEY. One more thing I have to announce, Dick.
Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, we've got to give a little bit more of a pause. I've gotten a number of emails that people from all out of the outlying areas or VOIP or Echo Link or whatever cannot get in because we're not waiting long enough, Dick.
Okay, so despite the fact that we've all got lots of enthusiasm, when you hear the beep, wait another second or two beyond the beep to make sure the whole network gets realigned, reinitiated, make sure it doesn't time out. Let's give a nice long pause. First of all, are there any other people to sign in besides Mel, Bernie, Bob, and Frank? Give me your call letters right now, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Call letters and name. K2RIW listening.
One additional bit of information, Dick. The folks on Echolink can type the word break, B-R-E-A-K, in their text window, and it will announce their call.
Okay. Give us a few more words on that, Eric. If you're on Echolink and you type the word break, it will announce your calls. In other words, are you sending your call letters by way of the touch phone pad? I'm a little bit confused by what that means. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. There is a text window on Echolink which allows you to communicate with other Echolink users. And because Echolink is assigned to you, your copy of Echolink actually knows your call sign. Bernie and I have a program from the guy who wrote Echolink. When you physically type the word break in the text window, it announces the synthesized voice up at the repeater site will announce your call. You've heard that in the past. You just may not be aware of it.
Very fine, Eric. I've heard a lot of things in the past that I've forgotten. I'm very light on computer information, so very good. So by way of that break command, people can therefore have their call letters announced, and therefore they can let us know that they're trying to add some words. Alrighty, one last call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet for the quick section, the first hour, so to speak? Give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW.
WB2BXO, Frank in Brooklyn.
Frank in Brooklyn, one of those guys from the Kings County Radio Club. Very fine, Frank. Alrighty. Bernie, Bob, Frank, and another Frank. Frank number one and Frank number two in that order. Bernie, you're number one on the runway. You came through louder than the other people during that pileup. And what quick question have you got for us tonight, Bernie? K2IO, K2RIW in the tech net.
Good evening, Dick in the net. The advantages of living in the shadow of the repeater site. Just a quick question about in the VHF world. Let's say that I'm putting up a Yagi antenna and I want to vertically polarize it. I need a mast to hold it up, and many times in the HF world that mast would be metallic, but we're horizontal, so the mast is, shall we say, not between the elements. But in a vertically polarized antenna, the mast is going to be coming up right in the middle of some of your probably your directors. What is the optimal solution? And how far, let's say that we could get a non-metallic mast, how far below the antenna would you want to stay non-metallic before you became metallic? Does that make any sense?
Makes a whole lot of sense and a lot of good questions there, Bernie. A very prevalent problem. There's two or three solutions to it. You can literally ignore it and you'll get by, or you can get more professional with at least two possible solutions. I, for one, am not in favor of the non-metallic mast for at least two reasons. Number one, the metallic mast gives you a hell of a lot more strength-to-weight ratio. No matter what material you use that's non-metallic, fiberglass gives you some deterioration. The PVC-type pipes start to, unless they've got ultraviolet protection, they start to bending in the wind and whatever. And the biggest problem is you're going to run your transmission line somewhere. And most likely you're going to want to run the transmission line up the mast. So even if you had a non-metallic mast, you've got this metallic object called the transmission line running there. So therefore, there's two other solutions. Let me drop. Number one, you can decide to set up not one vertically polarized, but two Yagis, side by side, horizontally displaced, both vertical, with a horizontal mast, horizontal piece of tubing going from your mast to those two Yagis. There's pros and cons to that. Number one, you get 3 dB more gain, but number two, you get a very complicated antenna pattern. What really happens when the mast is near a vertically polarized Yagi, the primary thing it does, and this is my result after doing a whole lot of backyard experiments, was to find out that the mast adds capacitance to the nearest directors. The nearest directors get extra capacitance, they get tuned to a lower frequency. Depending on your particular Yagi design, that could be a significant impact or a very minor impact. And you, being a smart enough guy who can do computer modeling, can readjust the length of those two nearest directors to bring them back on the same frequency. Let me drop. A Yagi is a number of parasitic elements. Each one of them has a particular center frequency and a particular location in the world. And put that all together with a good driven element, and you've got a Yagi. It does all that great focusing. So you can reestablish the frequency of desired resonance of those two nearest directors by making them a little bit shorter because of the capacitance added by the nearby mast. The next thing you're going to worry about is the mast creating a whole lot of effective cross-sectional area and giving you a blockage. That's the extremely minor one. Good common sense, dead wrong. A good Yagi on 2 meters, for instance, probably has an effective capture area of many tens of square feet. That mast you're talking about casts a shadow of a small fraction of 1 square foot. I've done a bunch of experiments on a high-resolution outdoor antenna range on this one, and you'd be amazed how little change in gain you get because of the shadowing effect of the mast. That's about as deep as I should go right now. I wonder if that all makes some sense, Bernie. K2IO, K2RIW in the TechNet. There's more to the story, by the way.
Well, thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for. A slight follow-on. By what you said, does this mean that when you side-mount an omnidirectional VHF antenna on a tower, that the tower is effectively not there?
There are a couple of computer programs used by Communication Products, or is that, I can't even think of the name of the company, the guys that make Station Master. They've got a computer program to tell you what is the most desirable distance from the tower for each individual antenna mounting. The tower does give you a minor perturbation to VSWR, does give you another reflecting device. But when you look at the true effective capture area of your vertical collinear antenna, if your eyes operated at that frequency and you looked at that thing in free space, let's say a four-element vertically polarized collinear station master antenna, you would see a huge oval, a black oval in space. It would be the oval would have more vertical dimension than horizontal. The collinear antenna would be in the middle of that oval, and that oval would have tremendously more area than what you see when you look at that antenna. That's where it's really capturing signal from, coupling it to that feed line, sending it down to the shack, and moving the S-meter, or moving the limiter stage, if you know what I mean. So therefore, for the most part, reasonable-sized towers at the right distance from the antenna are primarily transparent. If you choose the right distance for mounting that vertically polarized antenna alongside of the tower, and then you plotted the azimuthal pattern, it has a couple of bumps to it, and yes, there is a bit of a null in the direction of the tower, but that null is nowhere near as deep as you think unless the tower just happens to be a resonant length, which is very, very unlikely. Picking a number out of the air, maybe you're going to get 1.5 dB of notching of the antenna pattern in the direction of the tower. It's not a showstopper. K2IO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very interesting, very interesting. Thank you, Dick. Thank you for everybody on the net. I'll pass it on to let the next guy jump in. Dick, back to you.
And again, there's more to that story, Bernie, and we can get deeper into it. And what is that computer program really doing? Is it choosing the magic distance where you're an odd number of quarter waves or an even number of quarter waves to the tower where the reflection is co-phase or antiphase of what the antenna is doing? That's a little bit of it. At the desirable distances, you get a more circular pattern as opposed to a scalloped pattern and a little bit better standing wave ratio. That's what you're really tuning for. You don't want to mount the antenna directly against the tower. You want to have some real airspace in there. You don't want to short... You would really short out the antenna if you mounted it directly against the tower with, you know, a half inch of spacing. But once you add a couple of feet on a VHF, UHF antenna, you'd be amazed what the magic takes place. Okay, Bob was the next person who signed it. KC2 Alpha Zulu, I think it is. K2RIW. If I got your call letters correct, Bob, you got it. My name is Dick.
Dick,
Dick, no, you never get my call letters, right? It's Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Zulu. Anyway, my question is, I have a few of those linear amplifiers from the old analog cell phone towers. You see them on eBay. They're 900 megahertz, and they're 150 watt and 300 watt linears. And they're a nice compact package, and they're using one of the Motorola MRF transistors. I guess my question was, how difficult would it be to use that as a starting point to bring that thing down to 144? And primarily, I want to try and use it for talking to the ISS. And that's another question, if anybody has any experience doing that. Back to you, Dick.
I own quite a slew of those 900 megacycle linear amplifiers that we use in cell phone service that were being sold on the surplus market a few years ago. And I've gone through the process of converting them to 900 meg ham radio purposes. They got a whole lot of extra circuitry in there for control functions and linearizing and whatever. At first, I thought I was going to leave all that circuitry there. And at the great advice of people who had been there before me, and there was a website telling you how to do the conversion, by this guy in Texas. I can't think of his call letters or his name right now, but I can get that one for you. He's got a beautiful website telling you how to do the conversion, and basically you remove all the unnecessary hardware. Let me drop in. And after I give my little spiel, I'm going to send it over to Mel for his hint. So you remove all that hardware, and the remaining amplifier has got fantastic power output capability. I was using the 600-watt versions, and they will put out a solid 600 watts when you give them the right 28.5 volts or whatever, or the right number of amperes. Beautiful amplifiers. And the way that final stage has worked, and I blew out a few of those final stages because I didn't realize that there was one very lightly covered hint on the conversion procedure by this guy. what's the guy's call letters and name? You probably know who I'm talking about, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, I think it's on Ken Britton's thing, WA5VJB, over.
Yeah, he, WA5VJB, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo, .net or .org or .com, I'm not sure which it is, but you'll find that one real fast. Good old Ken Britton, his good buddy, it's a German-sounding name, my mind's going blank. Anyhow, he's got a beautiful conversion website telling you exactly how to do it. Somebody have that name? It sounded like somebody was going to give me that name. Anyhow, there's one hidden thing there that I missed, and that is the weakest link of that whole darn thing is that it's intended for a light-duty service when it's actually being used in cell phone service. It's handling a very complicated waveform, and it's giving you the bursts of power for very brief periods of time. Therefore, one of the plated through holes on the power output stage is extremely light, and you've got to add another piece of copper. You've got to add a piece of bus bar through that plated through hole and solder it down. Otherwise, that plated through hole burns up. Well, before I discovered that, I burned up a few of the final stages. There's four final stages in the 600-watt amplifier. Each one is running 150 watts, and a total of four of them get combined in combinations of two and two. Now, because of that power summing network, on two of these 150-watt stages, very carefully tuned to the roughly 900 megacycle region, plus or minus about about 100 megs. And because now the pairs of the two pair on the left and the two pair on the pair on the left and the pair on the right get recombined with another power divider, and you end up with a total of four stages, 150 watts each, being all very nicely combined in this beautiful Wilkinson hybrid type thing, and out comes 600 watts. And you can push it beyond 600 watts. If I had to take that 900 megahertz circuitry, let me drop, and move all of those beautiful, first of all, each of those 150 watt final stages are built on alumina substrate, very high class stuff. In other words, it's a very hard, white, ceramic material that has the microstrip that does the push-pull circuitry for the 150 watts. The 150 watts is really a pair of 75 watt transistors running in push-pull. So you got a total of eight transistors, silicon nitride, very high quality type transistors, and all of this fancy circuitry on the aluminum substrate with the built-in heatsink, extremely nicely designed, made for the 900 meg region. If I had to take that push-pull amplifier and hope that the transistors themselves, which are internally impedance matched to 900 megs, and normally when you go down in frequency, yes, you can do it, but to go that many octaves down, I'm not going to say it can't be done, Bob, but I am going to say it's a fairly healthy endeavor. That beautiful push-pull circuitry, you'd have to remove it entirely. And yes, you could cut it away and put your own larger inductor loop filter type thing. What is it now? It's a hairpin like your resonator between the two halves of each individual transistor operating in that push-pull mode for each 150-watt stage. Yes, you could cut that away and put in a bigger one. And yes, you could add your own power dividers and whatever. I wonder, and by the way, all of this power dividing and summing is going on the input of all of these stages as well as the output. So how much of the original circuitry are you really going to be left with after you do all of that conversion? Let me drop, got one more comment on this. You're going to be using the original transistors with their heat sinking. And the RF choke that brings B plus into them isn't going to work that down low in frequency. That's going to have to be replaced. When you study what the actual alumina substrate microstrip circuit is doing, it's got pieces of microstrip that jump very wide, very narrow in certain areas in order to do the broadband impedance matching at 900 megacycles. The real input impedance of each one of those transistors is probably around 3 ohms at 900 megs, and it's all being converted from a 50-ohm world and power divided. So, as you can tell, it's a healthy endeavor. Maybe you've got the technology to do it, Bob, by way of computer modeling and whatever. I'm just letting you know where the minefield is. It's a pretty tall order that you've asked for here. So, doable, and if you do it, I'd love to hear about it, and boy, you're going to write some great articles because, Dick, yeah, who's got another suggestion? Go ahead. Give a little bit of delay first.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to mention, in this strip line design, that's also the output filter. So if you wanted to do that, you'd actually have to leave all that stuff behind.
So as you can tell, there's a bunch of impedance matching and power dividing going on all the input circuits, a bunch of power summing and power combining going on the output circuits, a bunch of filtering, RF choking, stabilization networks, feed through to the printed circuit board and whatever. Wow. It's a healthy endeavor. Beautiful transistors. And the transistor itself has a beautiful data sheet from the manufacturer, and hopefully that data sheet will tell you what the impedance is versus frequency. I hope, for instance, that their Smith chart giving you input and output impedances versus frequency, I hope it goes all the way down to 150 megs. I'm a little worried that it's a transistor specifically designed for service at 900 megs. I'm a little worried that the data they're going to give you goes down to 750 and up to 1200, if you know what I mean. And so therefore, you might be in no man's land as far as the definition of the individual transistor performance and its characteristic input and output impedances when you go all the way down to the DC frequency from their point of view of 144 megs. From what you've heard so far, I wonder if you intend to go forward, Bob, and if so, we'd like to hear from you as you make the progress. It'll be quite a science project. I know it's doable. I'm just letting you know that my first cut is I think it's going to be darn difficult unless you're pretty well equipped. Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Zulu, K2RIW. Hope I got it right this time, Bob.
Yeah, you got the call sign right this time. Well, if I read you right, I think I should salvage the transistors, salvage the heat sink, and throw everything else away and start from scratch or go out there and find one of those pre-made boards from, you know, one of those other amateurs out there that make these boards, and you can buy everything but the transistor and maybe you can go that direction.
Yeah, there are other designs of high-power 2-meter amplifiers, solid-state, which may be a little bit easier. I'm slowly realizing who you are, Bob. You're a guy who lives in Huntington with me. It's your call letters or something. You and I talk once every 4 months or so, and I have to reacquire mentally who you are. Bob's, at least until recently, one of the substantial members of the Astronomical Society of Long Island, a really a group that's got interesting technology that they deal with when it comes to state-of-the-art telescopes and cameras. As I remember, Bob, you're one of the guys that acquired one of those very fancy charge couple device cameras when there was a group buy of those things a while back. So do a little bit of research. The good news is that there's a lot of watts for a lot of dollars, for not very many dollars, in those amplifiers. But 900 megs to 144 megs is an awful big move. And so go slow on that one. Otherwise, you're going to end up with an awful lot of hardware around the house that's not easy to use. Any other final comments on this one, Bob? AC2AZ, K2RIW.
No, I think that's it for me. I think I have a direction to go. I think I'll probably try and salvage the transistors and find somebody else's 144 port and marry it together. The other question was, has anybody hit the ISS before?
Okay. Lots of hams, I believe, had conversations, particularly school groups, International Space Station. There's a zillion school groups on Long Island that have talked to the International Space Station. If that's what you're asking, in other words, the school groups have done it because it was a pre-arranged schedule, so to speak. And I believe there are a number of individuals who joined in as a tail gun or whatever on that. Anybody with further information on communication as a private citizen, not necessarily as part of a school group, and talking to the International Space Station, anybody with information on that particular subject, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. In other words, it's only school groups and pre-arrangement, but these school groups have been reasonably successful. There must be at least four or five school groups. PCOMIC, among others, the PCOMIC Amateur Radio Club, has been involved in at least two of those operations, as well as some NASA clubs, to my knowledge. There must be somebody out there who can at least remember one of the school groups talking to the International Space Station in the last couple of years. If so, give us your call letters now and give us a couple of paragraphs on that. K2RIW.
This is N2RQ.
Go right ahead, Lou. I bet you your school and you have been involved in some of those. And tell us how many of you have been involved with and how many you are aware of. N2RQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, actually, you overestimate what I've done. The ARIS program, as you said, is by pre-arrangement with school groups, etc. But working individual QSOs with the space station is really depends on when they're on the air. I don't have any direct information on that, but I think it's just like working any other satellite, pretty much. I believe sometimes they have operators on, and sometimes they've got the radio in robot mode. Haven't gotten any information beyond that. Back to you, Dick. This is N2RQ.
Quick one. Go ahead, quick one.
Yeah, the present commander of the space station, Doug Whitlock, Hatchlock, something like that, he's an avid ham operator, so you can hear him on there quite often as the ISS flies overhead. Unfortunately, it seems to be a big competition. The guys on the West Coast acquire the ISS first, and they get on there, and he just talks like he's talking to buddies, you know. Of course, he's under no obligation to talk to anybody, so it's difficult sometimes to get a word in edgewise. You know, he'll sit there and talk halfway across the country to one person. I've heard a lot of scuttlebutt on there, a lot of people claiming that these guys should back off and let other people try, but then again, other people say, hey, the commander can talk to whoever he wants and for however long. So anyway, that's a little bit of what I know.
Yeah, thank you. That's good information. If you think about what's going on, when you launch a satellite into orbit, you almost always launch it going toward the east. And the reason you do that is the Earth is turning from west toward east, and the equator is moving roughly 1,000 miles an hour faster than if the Earth was not turning. So you get the first 1,000 miles an hour of getting you into orbit comes for free if you go to the west. Correction, if you go to the east. So therefore, all orbits per se, particularly with manned orbits, are going to the east. That means they cross over the west coast first before they come to the east coast. Even if they're coming up from the south or coming down from the north, so to speak, they're still hitting the west coast first. That gives them an advantage. And because of the altitude of the International Space Station, let me drop that astronaut with a good broadband antenna, broad beam width antenna, he's looking at something in the vicinity of 1,500 or 2,000 miles diameter of humanity all at once. And so there are various amateurs who have made a guess as to when his free period would be. If you do enough research, you can find out what his schedule is, his sleep period, his rest periods, and his free periods where he can do something, and you make a guess as to when the astronaut might be using the ham radio station, the International Space Station astronaut, and you make a guess and you give a call in the blind, and a few guys have been successful with that, but it's not easy. The prearranged schedules are a much nicer way to go as far as listening is concerned, but you don't want to interrupt them because the way the school groups usually work is they line up a whole lot of students with a whole bunch of questions. And as soon as the International Space Station comes over the horizon, the students start bombarding the astronaut with a whole bunch of questions, and they run out of time. If the satellite went straight overhead from acquisition of signal to loss of signal is something like 15 minutes, and they squeeze as many students as they can with their questions and answers in that 15 minutes, so there's essentially no time left over for an individual person to climb on board, if you know what I mean. And also the schools make an arrangement with NASA on these prearranged schedules, and they try to keep the frequency and the time as secret as possible so there aren't a bunch of people creating mischief on there. So maybe the best way is to join a school group, if you know what I mean. Okay, the next person was Frank, K2RSO. What would you like to ask us tonight, Frank? K2RIW on the TechNet.
I think you were calling me WB2BXO. Is that right, Dick?
No, there was another Frank first. A Kilo 2 Romeo Sierra Oscar. Unless I wrote it down incorrectly, K2RSO and K2BXO. Is there a K2RSO that signed in earlier? If so, give us your yay right now.
Okay, Dick, it's N2RSO, November 2, Romeo, Sierra, Oscar. The name is Frank. Good evening to you, good evening, Mel, and good evening to everyone else on the net. Let me just drop it a second, see if I have it.
You sure do. Sorry, I mixed up your call list. Frank number one, go right ahead, Frank. And wait for the beep, and then take your time.
Okay, thank you, Dick. My question tonight concerns fractal antennas. I know we've covered the subject before, a few months ago, but my memory was refreshed this evening. Channel 13, the show Nova, had their one-hour documentary on hunting the hidden dimension, the story of a fellow by the name of Benoit Mandelbrot, who discovered the mathematical geometry of fractals. And the show, which is a very interesting show, I suggest that anyone wanting to find out more about fractals look for it again on either Channel 13 or 21. They do show it periodically. And the most interesting part to AMS was the fact that someone has discovered a way to make fractal antennas. Let me drop it a second. And I have noticed that there's been a change in antennas on vehicles recently. At one time, just about every antenna was a vertical rod or tube. During the last few years, there's been a proliferation of rubber duck antennas, mostly at the rear of the vehicle on the roof. But in 2010 and 2011, many manufacturers have gone over to what looks like a shark's fin. And that led me thinking, could it be that these triangular shark fin antennas are actually fractals? That's question number one. If anyone knows that yes, they have gone over to fractal antennas. And number two, question, anyone know of any amateur radio fractal antennas available, either mag mount or permanent mount, for VHF or UHF or even dual band? Back to net and to RSO.
My goodness, Frank, have you asked the right question in the right place? Because, boy, do I have exposure to this one, at least portions of it. First of all, on that program that's on NOVA, you'll see a man named Nathan Cohen, and in the program, which was made roughly 1989, I think it was, his call letters then were November 1, India Romeo. Nathan Cohen, November 1, India Romeo. And when you see that fractal antenna printed circuit board on the left-hand side, you will see his call letters that he typed into the board. I sat down for a day with Nathan Cohen and the company that I was representing. In other words, as a consultant, we needed him to design a fractal antenna for our particular application. Nathan has changed his call letters. He's now Whiskey 1, Yankee Whiskey. If you go to QRZ.com and type in Whiskey 1, Yankee Whiskey, you'll see a beautiful story giving you a lot of information about his development of the fractal antenna company. Let me drop. Nathan opened up a company in the Boston area, and as I said, me and a bunch of other people from the company I was representing sat down with him for a day. And the fractal antennas definitely have some purposes. There's some definite places where they can be applied. In the case of a whip-like antenna, quarter-wave ground plane-like antenna, where the radiator is bent in a fractal-like manner, zigzag just right, you can make an extremely broadband antenna with a very simple feeding technique. And that was a couple of the products that Nathan has in his fractal antenna company. I can't think of the exact name of the company, but it's in his write-up when you go to Whiskey 1 Yankee Whiskey. And as I said, you'll get a lot of information there about what they can do and what they can't do, so to speak. What we needed at the time is we were building a 900 megacycle Yagi antenna, and we were hoping that the fractal approach would allow us to take the Yagi antenna, squeeze it down in physical size, the total amount of real estate it used, and therefore come up with the same performance. Nathan, at the time we first started discussing this with him, he also believed that that was possible. Let me drop. Upon further experimentation and computer modeling and whatever, and we discovered that is one of the places where fractal antennas probably don't have an application. To take a Yagi antenna and squeeze it down in size, yes, the individual elements with the Yagi approach can be made a little bit shorter, but when it comes to the total length of the boom, it turns out that when it comes to three and more elements of the Yagi-like antenna, the number of wavelengths of boom is the major determining factor as to what the gain of the antenna will be, as long as you're stacking a reasonable number of parasitic elements along that boom. And should you stack more or less parasitic elements to get more or less gain, that's not a direct relationship. It's not obvious. So fractals have definite application. Now, when it comes to that shark fin-like thing, in other words, the bunch of triangular holes in into a printed circuit board, very simple antennas, low-gain, patch-like antennas, can that give you more bandwidth and more possible frequencies of operation? Yes, it can. So if you want a relatively low-gain antenna with a lot of frequencies of operation, fractal can give that to you. If you want a whole lot of gain of the antenna, you've got to make the investment in real estate. Let me drop and I'll give you one more point on this one. The bedrock equation about antennas is that gain equals a constant times area. The constant is 4 pi a over lambda squared. So 4 pi over lambda squared is the constant. Once you fix the frequency, the amount of area you've dedicated to the antenna determines its realizable gain. You want to double the gain of the antenna, one means or another, electronically, you must double its area. So when it comes to high-gain antennas, you're going to invest the real estate. When it comes to simple low-gain antennas, monopole-like things, yes, fractals have got a lot to offer. And you would think that, the way the program was written, you would think that inside of every cell phone nowadays, and I've seen the inside of an awful lot of these things, you would think you're going to see a whole lot of fractal antennas. For the most part, you don't. I've seen a few of the attempts at fractal-like antennas for cell phone applications, and when it comes to the more miniature cell phones we're getting these days, where the hand can wrap around it, and therefore the hand can easily detune it, the fractal approach may not be the best approach. I know of a couple of approaches that are better. Not the whole story, but maybe that helps a little bit, Frank, number one. N2, Romeo Sierra Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you, Dick. I'll look him up on the internet and see what additional information I can find. It seems to me that with so many XYLs hating antennas, especially when they're on a new vehicle, that it would be very nice to have a low-profile shark fin antenna specifically for ham radio. So I'll keep looking for something that's available, especially if it's a mag mount, and that might prevent some arguments at home. So thank you again. You've answered most of my questions. Back to Ned and to RSO.
Let me add something else to this one, Frank, number one, and that is he used the word somewhere in the program, something like shark fin, when it comes to that complicated-looking pattern which has a whole bunch of triangles, smaller and smaller triangles, cut out into a conductor. There are some people who call that a shark fin-like patch antenna. Now, I'm also thinking about the number of the automobiles I've seen with a vertical-looking blade right above the rear window of the car, and it sticks up perpendicular to the roof of the car, and that certainly looks like a vertical shark fin. And maybe that's what you're referring to right now. And I think you're asking the question, is there a vertical shark fin-like setup for ham radio as opposed to the vertical whip? And I think the answer to that one right now is no, but I'm not sure. Is that what you were asking, Frank number one? Go ahead.
Yes, exactly, Dick.
And let me throw that open to the net. Does anyone know of a 2-meter or 450 antenna manufactured, or maybe a schematic diagram of where you can build one, that looks like the vertical shark fin that's on many automobiles that's established as a cell phone antenna? For whatever reason, the public has come to accept that kind of a cell phone antenna. And if you're ham radio...
Dick, it's satellite radio, those antennas.
Oh-ho. Oh-ho. That explains it. Alrighty, so people will accept that kind of an antenna for satellite radio. But you're saying that's... Yeah, I should have realized that almost everybody wants thorough portability.
By the way, it also has an antenna for terrestrial satellite radio. It is not only satellite, but it's terrestrial in the same band.
I hear you, Eric. And, so for those people who are willing to go for the extra service, so to speak, for satellite-like radio communication, they're willing to put that antenna on the car for reasons of everybody desiring extreme portability when it comes to their cell phone. Almost nobody is smart enough to put a whip antenna on the car. If they did, if they put a whip antenna on the car and connected a cable to their cell phone inside the car, all 80 or 90% of the dropouts they experience in certain areas with their cell phone wouldn't occur. But for whatever reason, that concept has not caught on. And I was making a guess that it had. Obviously, I was jumping the gun on this one. So it looks like that shark fin for ham radio purposes might not exist. Let me throw it out just one more time, see if anybody knows of a shark fin-like antenna designed for ham radio purposes that could be put on a car. Give us your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2L.
Go ahead, Bernie.
There is a company that makes a UHF. They also make a VHF version. You see them on taxi cabs, and they do have one that's cut in the ham band.
Any idea what brand name and where Frank would go to find a website on that one, Bernie?
I'm racking my brain, and I don't have it. If I could give Frank my email address when I got back to my computer, I could definitely find it.
Okay, so the guy we're talking to is November 2 Romeo Sierra Oscar, that particular Frank, who's requesting this info. And I guess your main reason for doing that is the wife will accept that shark fin antenna, but something that really looks ham radio-like, you're having a little bit more pushback. Is that approximately what's going on there, Frank number one?
You've got it, Dick.
Yeah, lucky for me, I talked my wife into getting a ham radio license, and I've convinced her that these pieces of hardware added to the car are high-tech scientific stuff, and it's a thing of beauty. Obviously, that's a very subjective opinion. When I look at cell phone base stations, I think I'm seeing a thing of beauty because I know what the darn thing can do. But I know full well that there's a significant portion of the population who thinks that they are visual pollution on the horizon, and they should all be hidden behind trees, real trees, not just phony trees. But that's another whole subject. Okay, good luck with that quest, Frank. Please come back whenever you discover the shark fin antenna, because there probably are other wives out there that will be very happy about their husbands having the information when you discover it.
Dick, just for Bernie, my email address, very simple, my call sign, N2RSO at ARRL.net. If he gets a chance and would like to send something forward, I'll be looking for it. Back to Ned and to RSO.
Actually, RSO, if you could look me up on QRZ and drop me an email when I get back to my house, then I can, I promise I don't have any way to write it down right now.
Okay, Bernie, will do. Thank you.
Question, Dick.
Go ahead, Alan.
You were talking about fractal antennas. I'd never heard of that before. The most I can gather here is that you're trying to reduce the length by simply folding it in a fractal pattern. Is that basically all this is?
That's a good beginning, Alan. I wouldn't say that's all there is. This guy, Nathan Cohen, starting in the late 80s and into the 90s, formed a corporation, a company, in the Boston area. And he also was part of this beautiful Nova series on fractals, which was on the air today, for instance. It's a rerun of that program, which was made at an earlier time. And if you take the mathematics of fractals, Mr. Mandelbrot, I can't think of his first name right now, he invented this mathematics. Benoit Mandelbrot, okay. He invented this mathematics some time ago. And so if you zigzag a piece of wire in the fractal mathematics technique, you do, when carried out correctly, and that's what Nathan discovered, Whiskey One Yankee Whiskey, go to his QRZ.com and you'll get about 8 paragraphs. He takes up almost as much space as your beautiful photographs on your QRZ.com site. And so he gives you a lot of information. And he discovered that when it comes to monopole-like antennas, zigzagged in that fractal mathematics manner, you can get a lot more frequencies, a little bit more compact size. But when it comes to high gain antennas, I don't think they have an advantage. There are some patch-like antennas. A patch antenna is one where you've got a flat ground plane and a very short distance above it, you have another flat metallic object that is the resonator slash radiator. And if you simply go to the Antenna Engineering Handbook or Amazon. Here we go. I'm trying to think of the search engine everyone uses. Google. If you Google the word patch, P-A-T-C-H, antenna, there's a lot of information on those. I've got a couple of patents on patch antennas, by the way. And so they have a lot to offer. And let me drop I just thought of something that Frank number one wants to know about. Frank number one, you should know. It is possible to build a patch antenna on 2 meters that uses the roof of the car as the ground plane, and the actual radiator would be, let me pick a number, approximately 3/4 inch above the roof of the car, and it would be a flat sheet of metal parallel to the roof of the car. The dimensions of it would be in the vicinity of 19 inches in one dimension, and maybe 38 inches is the right way to do it. The high-performance version would be a 38-inch, 37-inch square, 3/4 inch high, above the flat roof of the car. There's lots of ways that should be camouflaged. If you make it the same color as the car, and if the antenna now is only sitting 1/2 or 3/4 inch above the roof of the car, that's the total height of the antenna, and it's parallel and flat to the car, with proper coloring and camouflaging, nobody will see that as an antenna. And that will give you essentially the exact same performance as a quarter-wave vertical ground plane, and its antenna pattern could be omnidirectional on the horizon. Hey, Frank, do you see what I see? Do you see the possibilities of that? N2RSO, hope you're still there. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Still here, Dick. Thank you. I definitely see the possibilities there, and... matter of fact, I do have a can of touch-up paint that will match the vehicle. So when the weather gets a little warmer, I'll go outside and do a little experimenting. I'll let you know how I make out with it. I'll also do a little more research on the internet on patch antennas just to see exactly how they're wired. Thank you for the information, and back to Ned and to RSO.
K2YO with info.
Go ahead, Bernie.
The antenna company was called LARD, L-A-I-R-D. I'll repeat again, LARD, L-A-I-R-D. And they make low-profile UHF and VHF antennas, commonly seen on, like, taxi cabs. Police cars have them sometimes.
That company is pronounced Laird. And one of their very good antenna engineers I hired 2 years ago. He was working for the Boulder, Colorado division, which they closed down. And so, good company. And I think they've got a Chicago base for their major base of operation. And Laird makes some very nice antennas. And as I said, I hired one of their antenna engineers for the company I was working for at the time, about 2 or 3 years ago. And that man right now is off getting married. That's another whole story. But patch antennas, Frank, number one, let me drop. I recommend you do the research first, because there's a little bit of art and science. But to understand how a patch antenna works, assume I've got a square of metal parallel to your ground plane with about half inch or so of spacing with some kind of a Stucci dielectric material in there, spacing it, and you can see how that can make an extremely strong antenna. The version that I patented about 3 or 4 years ago, you can literally run it over with a Mack truck, and the antenna keeps on working and survives. That's a rugged antenna. When we've shown it to various people, they said, where's the radome? To which I said, why the hell would I put a radome on it and make it weaker? Because you would crush the radome before you would damage the antenna. And the way it works is that if I was using it in a linear polarized manner, the north end and the south end would be like a seesaw. At one instant of time, the north end would be positive, the south end would be negative, and a half cycle later it would be the opposite. That would be a linear polarized antenna that favored two directions of propagation. If you now fed it in a circular polarized manner, where you literally rocked it to the way a quarter settles down on the table, if voltage-wise you rocked it in that manner, it will make an omnidirectional, on-the-horizon antenna, very low profile, a little bit on the narrowband side, but rather high in performance, and could easily have 95% efficiency, and occupy very little volume on your car and be very well hidden. It's about time somebody make a product out of that. So do the research on patch antennas first, including looking up my name as far as the patent application. It'll give you some hints, Frank. Okay, let's go over to, let's see, first of all, if I answered Alan's question, I know we've only given you a very bare introduction to fractal antennas, but it's another whole branch of antennas. You could say there are 5,000 kinds of antennas, and now there's a few more because of fractals. KC2RFN for any other questions, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2RFN. I'm just looking it up online now, Dick, and reading it, and yeah, it's just a whole other area I never even knew existed. It's very interesting. So I'll look into that. Looks very. I'm actually seeing a picture of you at a microwave update 2007 in Philadelphia. Got you posing there with somebody when I was looking up patch antennas in K2RIW. That's what came up. But I'll look into that. Thanks, Dick. Back to that.
N2YJC.
N2YJC. Start off with your name, sir, and your comment on this subject.
Okay, good evening, Dick. Name is Lou. Just to throw in a quick comment, an XYL-friendly antenna on a car, usually the grass mount works pretty good. They don't complain that much about that. And another company on patch antennas you might want to look at is MobileMark, MobileMark. They make all sorts of radio communication, very small, buried in a radome kind of thing, which you can paint the same color as your car. They look very much like the GPS antennas you see on the newer cars, little... In fact, I think they do even make a shark fin looking one. Anyway, that's what I have on that. N2YJC, back to Net, and good evening, everybody.
Thank you very much for that information, Lou. Good stuff. The audio gain on your current transmitter is set extremely high. You're banging up against the sides of this repeater and creating square waves to your audio. So just talking softly would not be enough because the gain is set so high. I'm hearing every other sound going on in the room and all the echoes and whatever. So you got to readjust that gain, Lou, out of that good sounding information. Let's go over to Frank number two. Looks like we're barely going to squeeze this all in at 9 o'clock. We're meeting our schedule almost. WB2BXO, K2RIW. You got it, Frank.
This is a beep. Okay, Dick, very good. I've also got a wife-related question. Whatchamacallit, at my other location, we have an HDTV, and this is probably one that Eric can help with. We have an HDTV hooked up to over-the-air HD at our house in Philadelphia, where on channel 10, not on the sub-channels, 10.3, whatever, but on channel 10 itself, more often than not, we get no audio, though we do get the picture. And I have no idea what's going on with that. We haven't had a chance to hook it up to a different antenna or anything like that yet. But does that sound like something that might be signal strength related, given how differently HD works compared to the older analog TV? Is that it, Dick? WB2BXO.
Yeah, I got to ask you a quick question, and that is when you say on channel 10, not 10-1, 10-2, 3, or whatever, just channel 10, implies that you're listening to one of the remaining licenses for analog low-power television. That's what it implies, because all of the digital televisions will have a 10-1, 10-2, 10-3, and so whatever to it. So first of all, do you believe you're listening to a remaining license for a temporary period of time of low-power analog television? Is that what you believe you're listening to, Frank? Back to you, Frank, number two.
No, this is Philadelphia's high definition of channel 10. I, off the top of my head, maybe my wife knows. I'm not sure what that actually is, but it's the main channel 10. I'm sorry, what is it, Hunt? I'll tell you in a moment. Anyway, no, it's the main channel 10's programming, and it is the HD signal.
Let's see if Eric is available, since Eric works in broadcast. The channel 10 in Philadelphia, if it's high definition, as Frank number 2 is telling us, but it's not 10-1, 2, or 3, it's just channel 10, high definition, digital television, audio, missing in the Philadelphia area. He's asking what could be happening to make the audio disappear. If you're available, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. I heard you call my name, so I'm just catching what's going on. Say it again for me.
Frank in Brooklyn, WB2BXO, is listening to high-definition television, digital television, in the Philadelphia area when he goes to his other residence, if I understand. And it doesn't say 10-1, 2, or 3. It just says channel 10. He believes he's watching digital television, channel 10, Philadelphia area, and quite frequently he hears no audio. So, first of all, that there isn't a 10-1 or 2, 3 in there is making me curious. And second of all, I was at first guessing that he was listening to an old, remaining licensed, low-power analog television signal on channel 10. And he said, no, it's digital. But he's wondering why the audio is not there relatively often. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Ted corrected. It is 10-1. My wife just checked on that.
Fantastic. Still the same question. You got it, Eric.
Alright, K2RIW, K2EJ. I think that's WCAU, is that right?
He's not sure, but let's assume it is.
Alright. There can be a number of reasons why he's not decoding the audio stream. One is the signal's kind of weak and it's not a consistent decode. The audio is actually interleaved and packed in the stream in several places. also, depending upon the receiver, it may decide to lock on to a secondary audio stream instead of the primary audio stream. If that's the case, a lot of times, except what they call SAP in the old analog world, we still maintain that. And the receiver may actually be tuned to, in essence, audio channel 3 and 4 instead of channels 1 and 2.